our podcast is now going to pivot to uncovering butts.
You mean covering butts? I'm confused.
Oh, we're going to be covering uncovered butts.
The Bruce Willis edition.
Yep. Butts Willis. I can't believe you laughed at that. You should feel ashamed of yourself.
1, 2, 3, hit it, boy!
Whoa! Get together, have a few laughs.
Uh-oh! Shit, lady, do I sound like I'm ordering a pizza?
Lady, put the freaking gun down on the ground right now. Take your son across the freaking street and say that until he's gonna get you!
Hello, and welcome to Where There's a Willis, There's a Way, a film podcast about the multitude of works by Bruce Willis. My name is Josh Carter.
And I'm Kendrick Martin. Today, we are covering two movies.
Woo!
Mostly because there's two of us, and that's how we do base two math.
Yep. And so I'll be covering one movie entirely, and you will be entirely silent, and then you'll be covering a movie entirely, and I'll be entirely silent.
Mm-hmm.
And we did this episode together for that reason.
Yeah, it's better than alternatively, we talked about each of us recording different parts of the movie. So Josh would take a scene, I'd take a scene. Josh take a scene, I'd take a scene. Both of those ideas were madness. So yep. We pivoted to the third idea of just two movies.
Yep.
So the first movie we're going to be talking about is The Player, directed by Robert Altman, written by Michael Tolkin, and stars Tim Robbins.
We are also going to be discussing the movie Four Rooms, written and directed by Allison Anders, Alexander Boxwell, Robert Rodriguez, and Quentin Tarantino.
If this is your first time listening to this podcast, what we normally do is an in-depth breakdown of a movie starring Bruce Willis. But today, both of these movies have very small cameo roles of Bruce Willis, and we didn't want to ignore them because we are perfectionists and completionists, and so we have to do them all.
Are we signing ourselves up for this Rugrats movie that's coming up and the Beavis and Butthead movie?
I kind of want to do Beavis and Butthead. It's on HBO, so we don't have to rent it.
Oh, okay.
And I've never seen Beavis and Butthead.
Yeah, I watched like a minute clip of that movie and I was like, oh my fucking God, adult animation has come so far in just a few years.
It has. Though, one of the weird things is I don't know how big of a role Bruce Willis plays in that because he's listed high, pretty high up on the on the ratings, but having no idea.
I know that he has at least one scene. I think he might have a few, but
okay, because I didn't know if maybe he voices one of the main characters.
No, not one of the main characters.
Because okay. Muddy Grimes is his character name, and I have no idea how prevalent that character is. But he also does, yeah, was it Rugrats? And then there's another animated TV show.
Oh, Bruno the Kid.
Bruno the Kid.
Yep.
And Bruce, he loves his, Brucey boy, he loves his voiceovers.
Yep.
Stemming from that glory
those
days.
Look who's talking money.
Look who's talking. Yeah. So we're going to be talking about these two movies and we're going to break them down. We're going to break them up. We're going to piece them back together. We're going to make like a Transformers mecha model of the two of them. What am I thinking? What's that children's toy where you like break something down and mash it together with another one?
Legos? What are you talking about?
I just feel like
Play-Doh? Like what? That's most children's toys.
We're going to make a Play-Doh monster. Oh, I could have swore there was like a children's toy where you can just, it's like a Mr. Potato Head, but you just take pieces and other pieces and
like two Mr. Potato Heads stacked on top of each other.
Maybe I had a weird childhood.
I still think that you're just talking about Legos.
Yeah, we're going to take the two movies as Lego sets and put it together.
Yeah.
Do you think modern kids are going to refer to Legos as Minecraft IRL?
No, I would assume that most parents would introduce their kids to Legos before they'd introduce them to Minecraft. Mm,
but what about their kids?
Yeah, it's a good question.
Huh.
I mean, I wonder if like Lego seems like it has a pretty universal appeal. So I don't know if they're going to go away anytime soon, but maybe there will be a world where Minecraft sticks around and Lego goes
away.
Maybe,
maybe.
Be wild. I haven't actually ever played Minecraft.
Wow, really?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, my brother played it when it was still in Flash on the like web app, like in one of the earlier betas, and he's been playing it off and on just for a long time since then. So
I got really big into it right around that time and played it a lot with some friends online and then dropped off and haven't played it.
Yeah.
Since then.
Were you like a creative mode sort of player, or did you play like...
I would play adventure that. Mode with people. Oh, okay. And then sometimes I'd do creative mode and we'd just build like massive dynamite towers and
yeah.
see if we can just bring down the server by...
Yeah. by too many calculations yeah. having to be run at the same time.
I was never one of those people who's like made a life-size replica of the Starship Enterprise or something. Yeah. Like, I don't have that much free time.
I'm always impressed by stuff like that. Like, I'll watch videos of that and I'm going,
yeah.
oh my God.
they added HDR to Minecraft.
Yeah.
And I watched a YouTube video and I was like, what has happened?
Yep. Yeah, and ray tracing. They yeah. added that to Minecraft as well, yeah. and you're like, what the hell?
yeah, my mind was blown.
Yeah, it's wild how like you can make some games just look amazing, even with just some of these little tweaks that are coming out and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's going to be wild. Well, this episode is not called Minecraft Talk, so...
where there's a mine, there's a craft?
Where there's a mine, there's a craft. So we're gonna get into both of these movies. We're gonna go through and kind of talk about one of them, and then kind of a record scratch, and then go back and talk about the first or the second one, and then spin the wheel twice actually. So you guys get double the wheel spin for this one episode. So Kendrick, let's talk about The Player first. So I watched The Player twice now. I watched it once when we were watching the Death Becomes Her episode because I was watching them through in order. So I watched The Player and then Death Becomes Her the same day, and I like The Player a lot more than Death Becomes Her. And then I just recently rewatched it for this episode. And you've seen it once, right? You didn't watch it
yeah,
when it
I
came
just,
out or anything?
I just watched it recently for okay. this. I didn't watch it originally when you did.
Okay. And so I guess if you were to rate that movie a Bruce Willis out of a Bruce Willis, where are you going to rate it? Or did you... thumbs up, thumbs down, where are you putting
this? I remember when you watched it, you were really in love with it, and you said, oh yeah, man, that's part of the reason why we're doing this episode, is because yeah. even for his little be Willy content, we have high Josh love content.
Yep. So yeah. I'm single-handedly dragging us through this episode even if you don't want to be here.
I thought it was fine. I think it was had a lot of interesting bits, but I wasn't in love with it while I was watching it.
Yeah.
And I think I would rate it a Bruck, slightly under a Bruce.
Oh, really?
I think there are specific people out there who would like watching it,
mm-hmm.
but for the most part, I didn't find it funny enough, and I thought it a little too long.
Mm.
And the ending dragged on a little bit to me because you could kind of tell where the movie's going a little bit.
Yeah.
But the opening bits, which we'll get to, were amazing.
Yeah.
And then it just takes a sharp downhill and I'm like, oh.
It's an actual movie. It's not going to be one giant long take. Yeah. 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 This episode's probably going to be one of our biggest differences because you rated it a Bruck. I'm actually going to give this movie a Bruce Willie.
Whoa.
Yeah. I'm throwing that Bruce Willie slider pretty high up there. I remember watching this and I created a second Letterboxd list, one that has all the cameos and all of his regular movies that we're also covering, and then one that was just for his regular movies. And I was like, wow, this is going to the top of my list because I liked it a lot. I think that there's a lot of really good things in it. What you said, though, is a really good point, that you do have to kind of like, you have to be a certain type of person, I think, to get a lot out of this movie. And I think that if you're yeah, it's interesting that you didn't like it because, like, what I was going to say is I feel like you have to be kind of somebody who really appreciates the critiques of Hollywood that this movie has to offer, and you have to like Hollywood as well because it's, like, a very Hollywood-esque made anti-Hollywood movie. Like, the messaging is anti-Hollywood, but the sheen that's on top of it is a very, like, Hollywood-esque picture. There's, like, a really long take at the beginning that we'll get to. Most of the movie is not shot with like handheld. It's all like slow dolly pans or slow zooms that kind of accentuate different things. So it's not like a guerrilla filmmaking style by any means. But if you are down with the message, I feel like you'll probably like it. But like the movie does have a lot of weird quirks to it for sure.
All right. So that was The Player. Should we also give a thumbs up, thumbs down on Four Rooms right now, or do that before we talk about Four Rooms?
Oh, I should probably do that before we talk about Four Rooms.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, if you're listening and you want to email us and tell us how much you loved or hated The Player, or how much you love and hate Hollywood, tweet at us. Tweet at us with your Hollywood thoughts. You can find us on Twitter, Willis Way Pod, or you can hit us up on Facebook by going to The Last of the Action Heroes Facebook page. The Last of the Action Heroes is a podcast network of other action heroes, along with Bruce Willis, and there's a lot of great podcasts on there, and a lot of great other people making podcasts. And I'm always amazed at some of the stuff that comes up on there, because podcasting is such a wild art form.
Oh, yes.
I mean, here we are making a podcast about Bruce Willis, but there are all kinds of podcasts about all kinds of movies. And the fact that they've coalesced under this one network is kind of neat, because I would not go out and search like a Dolph Lundgren podcast, but mm-hmm. I can find it this way.
Yep.
which is kind of the whole point, because no one is going to listen to them all at once, but you can be like, oh, I really like that set of people. That sounds fun. So
yeah,
check it out. All right. So let's dive into talking about The Player.
From director Robert Altman comes a story of Hollywood.
I got a writer in here who's got a pitch I think you ought to hear. I think it's hot.
We open outside San Quentin.
The Graduate, part two. And Mrs. Robinson had a stroke, so she can't talk.
It's going to be funny?
Yeah, it'll be funny.
Griffin Mill is a hotshot studio executive.
Yes. Angelica, Griffin Mill.
Oh, hi.
Good to see you.
Malcolm McDowell.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Bert.
Good to see you.
He's heard every pitch.
That's exactly right. It's Out of Africa meets Pretty Woman.
He knows all the angles.
We're going to have a little sex in this.
Oh, yeah, sure, of course. We'll get it.
Slowly, he pushes her panties down to her knees.
And all the players.
We're the stars.
No stars.
No stars?
Bruce Willis.
I want Bruce Willis.
Not Bruce Willis.
No Schwarzenegger.
Julia Roberts.
Now, he's about to star.
How did this get here?
They're coming from a writer.
Hello, is David Kane there, please?
This is?
This is Griffin Mill.
Oh, the dead man.
In his most unforgettable story yet.
Stop all the postcards.
I don't write postcards. I write postcards.
This is a tough story. A tragedy.
Not unlike Ghost meets Manchurian Candidate.
The trouble is,
something you have to know.
If you went to Pasadena with intent to kill, you could go to the gas chamber.
It's not a movie.
I'd like you to come down to the station.
I would hate to get the wrong person arrested.
Oh, please. This is Pasadena. We do not arrest the wrong person. That's L.A.
It's his life.
Are you seeing someone else?
You took her to a party, Griffin, with several hundred of my best friends.
Do places like this really exist?
Only in the movies.
Robert Altman's The Player.
Can we talk about something other than Hollywood for a change?
Yeah. Yes.
We're educated people.
Yeah. Sure. Oh my God.
Well, that audio was from the trailer of The Player. I'm going to read the description from IMDb. A Hollywood studio executive is being sent death threats by a writer whose script he rejected, but which one? You can find this movie for rent on video on demand, or you can find it on HBO as of now. So, Kendrick.
Was it on HBO? I swear I paid for this movie.
You paid for it?
I looked on
you
HBO.
Chump.
I looked on HBO and it wasn't there.
Yeah, absolute chump. It was there on the 4th, so.
They probably took it off the 1 week I watched it.
Yeah.
Warner Media.
So you didn't like this movie as much as I did.
Correct.
Yeah. So I guess, do you want to hear?
I liked it okay. I just wasn't head over heels with it.
Okay. Do you think that was also part of because I maybe oversold it?
I think probably a little
bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was kind of fearing that might have been the case. Yeah. I don't know. There is a lot of stuff to really like about it. So you really like the opening, you said.
Yeah. So we're going to spoil this whole movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry. yes, definitely.
And the opening bit, which goes on for 10 minutes. I didn't
it's
count
7 minutes and 49 seconds. I just looked it up.
But,
or 7 minutes and 40 something
seconds.
Because
at some point, so it's a single take, and yep. The camera follows people around in this lot at a movie studio. Mm-hmm. The movie studio or whatever. I don't remember the name of the studio, but it's some like... at the movies or something dumb. And Tim Robbins' character is a screenwriter.
Producer.
And he's getting people coming in and out of his office.
Mm-hmm.
And the camera is kind of panning around the parking lot. And you're seeing people coming and going and assistants arriving and leaving and running on errands and showing up with packages.
Yeah.
And having conversations. And a lot of famous people have walkthroughs. And they're playing themselves because they're on a Hollywood set. And they're talking about other famous people. So they'll be like, oh, I want to get, you know, so-and-so for this movie or whatever.
I think we can get Schwarzenegger for that role or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. And I thought that was all really funny and excellently crafted. And they even kind of self-reference themselves because like, don't you love long openings to movies? Like, I don't remember who they're like, the six-minute opening was so great.
And yeah, and
like,
movies ha-ha. These days, it's cut. And you're like, okay.
I was like, haha, this movie is like very self-referential and funny. And that part was all really good, mm-hmm. but I could not care about the Tim Robbins character at all.
Oh, you couldn't?
And I was just like so bored with him. And then, so the whole plot of his movie is he's getting all these death threats.
Yeah.
He's getting all these death threats. And then he thinks he knows who it is, and he accidentally kills the guy.
Yep. And the guy's played by Vincent D'Onofrio. I feel like we should shout him out.
Yeah.
Because I love that man.
Yeah, his role was great. I loved how you find out where he's like, I was just here watching movies. I wasn't sending you death threats at all.
Yep.
And so, he gets killed. And then Tim Robbins is like, well, I'm going to steal your woman and go off with her.
Yeah.
And then he still gets death threats. And I'm like, I just don't care about what's going on. I didn't empathize with his producer character.
Yeah.
And I was with him until he killed that guy, and then I was like, I just don't care anymore.
Yeah.
And like I said, the movie's over 2 hours, and that happened at like the 90-minute mark, and there's still a lot of movie left. Probably more.
It happened way earlier than that. It's like within the first 30 minutes that the writer dies.
No, it's a little longer than that.
You think?
Yeah, because there's that opening scene, which is
6 minutes.
And then there's
maybe it is like 45 minutes.
A lot of the stuff
something.
With the girlfriend, and they go. He goes to
the movie.
There's a party, and then
maybe
he goes
it is
to,
like an hour.
He sneaks in around his girlfriend's house, which is really bizarre. Like he's acting very like. I wanted the more of the movie to be spent with him freaking out about death threats and like no one really taking him serious, and it also waits too long, in my opinion, to introduce that other producer who's like his competitor that they hired from the other studio, and he gets like nervous about his job. Because I think we're supposed to kind of get the idea that the studio is in a rut because they're having a hard time finding a good script. And I was never led to believe, is that Tim Robbins' fault or not?
Yeah. I don't know that it really matters that it's his fault, though.
Yeah. And so I'm like, is he trying? Is he not trying? Does he care?
Yeah.
I don't know. That stuff didn't really work for me. But the opening stuff really worked. And several like comedic bits really worked.
Okay.
But
I mean, if you can't get down with the like baseline like character motivation, it's going to be hard to sell you on the rest of the movie.
I did not care for that at all. Let's go back to that opening scene. One of the things I loved about it was how the audio transitioned so well, because several times the camera is in the parking lot and it'll have a conversation with someone in the parking lot talking to each other. And then the camera will pan and you'll see through the window of someone in a building talking, and they'll be the audio that you're hearing now.
Yep.
It'll be on the phone and you'll hear and it just was like, not only was the camera like one long take of all these different scenes, but the audio was like seamlessly interwoven with all these different layered things that I thought worked really well.
Yeah. That was super, super impressive. Just this film, technically, it kind of blows my mind in a lot of different ways. And
I was super happy with that whole opening.
Yeah.
I think if you can find this movie on HBO and not have to pay the $5 like I did, watch it for that part alone.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I do think that opening sequence is really great, but it does all hinge on whether or not you can identify with Tim Robbins' character and whether or not you can empathize with him. I feel like I could empathize with him, but I don't know if I'm like already a little bit of a sociopathic, you know, like bossy person by nature. And so I'm like, hey, I identify with this asshole producer guy, but like all of the stuff that he does, I feel like happens so gradually. Like this movie doesn't send him over the edge just instantly. It kind of takes his time with this character, and as soon as he kills David Kahane, he kills him kind of by accident, kind of. Like, he would probably still go to jail, and so he doesn't want that, but he did get attacked, and then he kind of, like, retaliated after the fact. So you're kind of like, okay, I could see how that could happen to a human. But then he just tries to go on living his life, and he becomes, like, way more disheveled throughout the rest of the movie. And it's so fun to see Tim Robbins just, like, absolutely losing it. I thought he just did so, so good in this role.
Yeah, he just, like, completely collapses in on himself.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I've found... So this premise is fairly common in movies, right? Where someone accidentally does something and they have to cover it up, and then the rest of the movie is them covering it up. But yeah. I think what I love about those movies is they become increasingly more plate juggling. Mm-hmm. So he does something, and then to cover it up, he has to do something else. And then to cover it up later, he has to do something else.
Comes like a Rube Goldberg of
cover-ups. Yeah, and then it's just like, how ridiculous of a scenario can we put our protagonist in where he has to continue covering everything up? Mm-hmm. And I don't think that this movie really ever goes there. Well, he has to cover up the first thing, and he, like, maintains that cover up, but he doesn't continually digging himself in a hole. Like, he has, like, an alibi that he lies to the cops about, but it's not like other stuff falling apart around him as because he's lying about the alibi.
Yeah.
And then
that's true.
And then I also couldn't really understand why I don't buy the relationship with the girlfriend that he, like, falls in love with, and they run away to Mexico or the desert or whatever, they're going to that resort.
Yeah.
And he leaves his previous girlfriend, which up until then I kind of bought that he cared for her. Like, he seemed legitimately giving her ways to improve her standing at the company with that producer role in New York he sends her out on. But it just all felt like he was in a trance where after he killed that guy, he operates the rest of the movie as if, like, he's playing the part. And so I never see the passion that I believe you would need in order to do some of those things. It just seems like he's constantly like, I don't know what to do here. I'm gonna do this.
Yeah. I think also the kind of part of the difference is, like, whether or not you're looking at the movie just as a mostly as an allegory rather than, like, a literal movie. Because I feel like if you take it as, like, an allegory of, like, Hollywood is killing off the good writers' ideas and stuff like that, and it's the producers that don't care, and then they'll swoop in and take everything from the writer, I think that kind of works a little bit better. Like, the message behind the movie works better for me than the message of the movie, but I really like the message behind the movie. And so I think that probably sways my opinion a little bit. Cause if you look at it just, like, literally what's on the pages, I totally agree with you. I can see definitely where you're coming from. But I think that when it's set up to be looked at more as, like, a metaphor or an allegory, you can kind of get more what the movie is trying to say. So, if that makes sense.
I think for me, the movie would have worked a lot better. This is strange to say, but I think the movie would have worked a lot better if it had just gone way more comedy instead of film noir vibes.
Yeah.
Which normally my, you know, personality is much more likable to film noirs or dramas. But this movie, I felt like it wanted to be, like, full-throated comedy.
Yeah.
And the jokes kind of disappeared throughout them.
Yeah.
The middle of the movie.
There are some really good jokes, though, in the movie.
Yeah.
A lot of them by our man Richard E. Grant from Hudson Hawk fame, who plays, like, this neurotic writer who is going throughout the movie, and, like, his whole thing is he's like, no Hollywood stars, just talent. And, like, that's his whole thing whenever he's trying to pitch his movie, which is crazy and stuff. Yeah. I really liked him in this movie. I really liked Whoopi Goldberg in this movie, I thought was really good. And obviously we've already shouted him out, but Vincent D'Onofrio I thought was really fun.
Yeah, the cast is just, like, everybody in Hollywood.
That too.
I think we talked about this in our Sunset episode, so that was a while ago, 20 episodes ago.
I don't know,
it was a while ago. But Hollywood loves making movies about Hollywood.
Yep.
We've seen this throughout the entirety of Hollywood existing. And there is just every once in a while, Hollywood studios produce a film that is purely like a self-referential mm-hmm. movie about Hollywood that you really have to, it's for people who like movies and talk about Hollywood stuff. Mm-hmm. And this is definitely like in that vein.
Oh, totally. Although I like this more than like a Hail Caesar, which I did not like much at all.
I liked Hail Caesar okay. I probably put them about the same.
Yeah.
I didn't love it, didn't hate it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I'm going to try to see if I had anything else in there that I was really want to talk about with the player. Oh, yeah. We'll talk about Bruce Willis in a bit, but he is name dropped throughout this entire movie. So you kind of know that his part's coming up, and his part does not disappoint. And within the context of the movie, it's so, so, so funny. Yeah, because throughout the movie, they keep on saying how there's like a movie within a movie that's being made called Habeas Corpus or something like that, where it's like a movie where at the end it's supposed to end very tragically and it's not supposed to have a happy Hollywood ending and stuff like that, which is then mirrored by the actual ending of the movie. And Richard E. Grant's writer character is like, yeah, there's not going to be any Hollywood stars. It's going to be like its own thing. And then it's not going to have a happy ending either. And then at the end of the movie, like, the movie is going to end sad. The movie within the movie is going to end sad. And then all of a sudden, like, Bruce Willis comes running in to save the day, and it does not end sad at all. Bruce Willis gets in a punchline and everything. And
yeah,
he
has a great one-liner. And they make a point of when talking about this movie in preparation of, like, no stars. We don't want anyone in it.
Yeah.
And then it's
Julia Roberts.
Yeah, Julia Roberts.
Yeah.
Playing the woman who's about to die, and then Bruce Willis is the guy who comes in and saves her. And I was like,
two of like the biggest names that have been name dropped throughout the entirety of the movie.
This is the heyday of both of their career too.
Yeah. And they were both, they're both really good friends in real life. So they both hang out with each other. And Bruce Willis was in Ocean's 12 on Julia Roberts' like behalf. She was like, hey, you want to do a cameo in this? And he's hilarious in that movie as himself. It's good stuff. I thought that he was really funny in this movie. And I think he was definitely worth the wait, because I kept like looking at the time stamp the first time I was watching it, and I was like, man, when does my Willy Boy show up?
Yeah, I know. I had the same thought, because I was like, I was expecting him to be in the beginning when they're showing you a whole bunch of famous people. Or
there's
a party like halfway, two thirds through, where you meet a bunch of other just famous people. I think like Madonna or Cher.
Cher's
there. And I'm like, oh, we're going to see him here. And then I I'm like, well, we only got one thing left.
Yep. Oh, and I forgot to mention, we have another Hudson Hawk crossover, because Andie MacDowell is also in
this
movie as well. Yeah. She has a cameo as herself.
I saw her and I was like, wait, is that? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we have three Hudson Hawk actors in this movie. That I know of. There might be other ones, so I'm sure that somebody will tell me.
Okay. The player topics do we want to get to?
That was it. I feel like I made my piece about why I really liked it and stuff, but obviously it's one of those movies where it's a little bit more divisive, so I guess go in with an open mind. If you can watch it for free, I'd recommend it. But
yeah, I think if you like movie, like Hollywood, if you care about movies as movies and less as specific things, if you're looking for something specific, you might not find it. But if you just want to watch like a fun movie about Hollywood, watch the first part of this movie.
Yeah. As far as the money goes for this movie, a lot of the actors that were in it did their cameos for free. Like almost every single one did. And apparently if all the actors had done their cameos for their regular asking price of like minute to pay, this movie would have been like over $100 million to film just on the salaries of the actors alone. But this movie cost only $8 million to make, and it made $28.9 million at the box office. So It's a good little return.
I am curious as to, I did not look up any reviews for this movie. I wonder how this movie would have played in the 90s, where you don't have a lot of internet culture kind of driving interest in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
If this movie outside of LA, how well it would have done. Because I think a lot of people in California might have liked it because of the Hollywood references.
Yeah.
But I don't know if people, you know, if people in Texas, people like Dallas, Texas,
yeah,
people have been interested in this.
I don't know how much it appeals to like the everyman.
Yeah.
USA person. But yeah, I mean, it did really well critically. The movie has like a 90-something% on Rotten Tomatoes, I'm pretty sure. And both Siskel and Ebert rated it a 4 out of 4. So they both really liked it. But
interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did not have a chance to look up their reviews ahead of time. So that's interesting. The Star Trek connection for this, obviously, long list of
lots
people.
Lots of them.
I just want to call out Whoopi Goldberg probably has the biggest.
Oh, duh. How did I not think of Whoopi Goldberg? Yeah.
When you were like, I wonder who this is going to be. And I'm like, well, I don't want to tell you, but it's pretty obvious. She has the biggest, probably the biggest Star Trek presence of anybody in this movie. And she definitely has the biggest movie presence of any Star Trek character. She plays a police detective, police chief.
Yeah,
something in the police, and she has some pretty funny lines. There's a line in the trailer about how Tim Robbins, who's under suspect for the killing, he's like, "You got the wrong man," and she goes, "Oh, we don't have the wrong man. That's L.A.
Mm-hmm.
It's in like Mendocino or San Bernardino or some other California town." I thought that was funny.
Yep. Yeah, and what's the guy's name that is a musician who's also in this movie? Lyle Lovett, is that his name?
I believe so. I don't
remember. Yeah. Yeah. So like Lyle Lovett, he plays like another one of the police officers and you're like, what's going on with him? And then all of a sudden he ends up being like,
that's right.
Just like a red herring. And you're like, oh my God.
Yeah. I forgot about that.
Yeah. But I love that like LA police scene where they're like interrogating Tim Robbins and it's just showing his eyes like darting from left to right. And like, he's just sweating so much in that sequence. You're like, oh no.
Yeah. Yeah, there was some funny stuff in that police scene where they're like,
And like the tampons go missing and they have like this whole sequence about that.
She's like looking for she's like, these tampons are the wrong kind of tampons. And they're just like, it's just all
while he's being interrogated.
Yeah, and
so
they're like, hey, do you want to talk? And he's like, yeah, let's go into your office. And she's like, that's not my office. Let's just sit at this desk. And it's like stuff all over the desk. Yeah. And he's just like, what's going on? He's just very confused.
Oh, man.
Which you can't really tell if it was done to throw him off, like you want the person being interrogated to be kind of thrown off, or if it was just literally a bumbling police station.
Yeah,
both work. And
yeah,
I thought that part was funny.
Yeah. So I think that the humor stuff worked better for you than everything else in the movie. Okay.
And I think that kind of movie needs to be funny for me because it's like such a farce.
Yeah.
That it needs to focus on its funny.
That's fair.
Plus Tim Robbins is a funny guy.
Not in that movie.
Let's talk about Four Rooms.
All right.
As you would say if you were in Narnia, Four Ooms.
Four Ooms. Mr. Thomas.
Is it Narnia that they talk about the spare oom?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I was like,
Lucy Pevensey of spare oom.
All of a sudden I was like, wait, is that Harry Potter?
No. No. I would know because that brought back childhood memories, and Harry Potter would not have brought back childhood memories because I did not watch those until I was an adult.
Oh, they're also books, Josh.
Well, I did not read those until I not actually read those at all. Okay. So,
wow. I also have only read the first one.
Ah, okay. Well, if you want to start a book club with us where we read through Harry Potter and then talk through the Bruce Willis connection with Harry Potter.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, might as well. It's too bad that Bruce Willis wasn't in a Harry Potter movie.
Yeah, although if he had been in like Harry Potter 5 or something, would you have just watched the fifth one?
No, I would have watched all of them, I think. Because he's only in like the end of one of the movies that's coming up, Split. Because like Split, you didn't know it, but it's a sequel to Unbreakable. Sequel. Yeah. And then,
spoilers for Split, I suppose.
Yeah, spoilers for Split. But I mean, we're going to get to it later, so... I mean, yeah, at some point. But yeah, I feel like I would have to watch Split, even though it's like probably not going to be super, super related to Glass. I don't know.
I've seen them all.
Yeah. Like, I'm guessing I have to watch Split.
It. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah,
all right. Yeah, yeah. There you go. Yeah. So I would watch Harry Potter 1-5.
Okay. Well, if you are listening and you want to write your fan fiction on Bruce Willis and Harry Potter, shoot us an email, willisweypod@gmail.com.
Yeah. If you could please write like a fanfic from like the perspective of somebody working on the production for Harry Potter and then how it is working with Bruce Willis there in the role of whatever. And just, you know, the behind the scenes stuff, and it's all fanfic. I would definitely read that.
There's one Bruce Will or one Bruce Willis. There's one Harry Potter movie that has like all the famous people in it. All the famous actors, right?
I mean, like Harry Potter 3 has like a what's his face? Gary Oldman in it.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
And isn't Benicio del Toro in some of them, or am I mistaken? I haven't seen him in a long time.
I don't know. I've only seen 1-6. Oh. I haven't seen the end of it. I just haven't gotten around to it yet.
You're just
know.
Like something ring right.
I know that one
something.
Of the I know that like one of the
Captain
twins
Picard
die.
Shows up.
I don't know. Oh, yeah. my knowledge of it is so sporadic. Yeah. And
once the Death Star gets blown up, I'm just totally lost.
Yeah, and then like the Enterprise flies in, and you're like, please no, this is so confusing.
Yeah.
Yep.
Speaking of confusing, let's talk about Four Ooms.
Four Ooms.
This year, Miramax Films takes great pride in extending to you an advance invitation to celebrate New Year's Eve at the Monsignor Hotel, where a dozen of the most unusual guests ever will check in.
We have reservations.
And a lone bellhop named
Dead.
On his first day on the job.
All you have to do is hold the fort.
And the night's cake.
Okay.
Is in for the night of his life.
Kato, what's the problem?
I haven't got a problem. I've got problems. Plural.
My children are staying here tonight watching TV.
Get a bottle opener.
If something happens to my children, they wouldn't want to be you.
The five of us are a coven.
A coven of witches.
An oven full of witches.
A coven of witches!
Tell me that's not a face you can trust.
I can't handle this hotel by myself!
Are you saying my wife cheats on me?
I've got to get out of here. We want you to... I am not gonna cut off Norman's little...
Hell of a night, huh, Ted?
I'm stuck in a situation here which I couldn't possibly begin to explain.
Tim Roth, Antonio Banderas, Jennifer Beals, Valeria Golino, Madonna, Ione Sky, Lily Taylor, Marissa Tomei, and Tamlin Tomita in a new film from directors Alison Anders, Alexander Rockwell, Robert Rodriguez, and Quentin Tarantino. Four Rooms.
I've had a real bad night.
Oh. Really?
That audio was from the trailer of Four Rooms. The description is pretty short, but the IMDb description is: four interlocking tales take place in a fading hotel on New Year's Eve. So we mentioned up front that this movie has four writers and directors. The format of this movie is pretty straightforward. It's a story of a hotel bellman who goes to four different rooms in the hotel, and each room is a pretty much a self-contained scene, and each of the writer directors wrote and directed their particular scene. So let's talk about the framing device, and then we'll just walk through the four scenes.
I think that
sounds good
sense,
to you, Josh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Tim Roth plays this bellman, mm-hmm. and it's his first day at this hotel, and it's a aging classic hotel in Hollywood.
Yeah.
I don't know if I just blinked too fast or what, but I saw him talking to an old bellhop about what it means to be a bellhop.
Mm-hmm.
And then from that trailer, it seems that there's a scene where the boss is like, you just got to cover it tonight. You'll be fine all by yourself.
And I think that scene was cut.
Okay. Cause I was yeah. like, I read the description cause I later I was wondering if there was his first night.
Yeah.
And I, because it wasn't clear, because he seemed pretty like adapted at his job, but he was there all by himself. And he, but the movie description in Wikipedia or something says that it was his first night on the job.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, well, that explains that. So yeah.
I don't think that's made super clear in the film, though.
It's not. And he never seems to suffer doing his job. He only gets more and more bewildered because of the ridiculous scenarios he's playing.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much the framing device, and there's very little connective tissue, although each scene has a little bit of reference to the previous scene.
Yeah.
And then the final scene kind of culminates in a couple more connective tissue, but there's really not a whole lot connecting any of the issues.
Although I did learn that the movie is not filmed, or it's not, doesn't take place sequentially.
It's not supposed to?
No, it doesn't. So it goes room one, and then it goes into the first part of room three, and then he leaves, and then room two happens in its entirety, and then the rest of room three happens, and then room four happens.
Oh, I could see that.
Yeah.
That makes sense. I don't...
Apparently, like, there's like some prop that you can tell is changed, and so that's how you know that it took place in that order.
I don't feel like that makes a change either way.
Well, it does, because... So, I mean, we'll get into it, but like this is like one of those types of films where it's like one bad night or one crazy night or whatever that film genre is called, where it's like something just horrible happens to somebody, and it is us watching their life fall apart over the course of one night. And that's what it felt like with this Tim Roth character, where you're just seeing his like entire life come crashing down around him, or his entire job, I guess, come crashing down around him. And I kept having the thought that I think you had expressed a few movies ago, where you're like, why doesn't he just leave? Like, just get out of there. And so the fact that in part three at the beginning, he takes money to babysit kids, that makes it make sense for me why he stayed there after getting a gun pointed at him. So I guess that's the only reason why. Spoilers, by the way, we're going to be spoiling this entire well. But yeah, that's the only reason why I feel like it makes sense that they happen out of order. Because like otherwise I'd be, nope, I'm gone.
All right. That didn't occur to me because Tim Roth plays just at an 11 for most of this movie. Oh, and
maybe a 12 even.
Yeah.
Like.
at some point I thought, I was like, is he mute? Does he not talk? Because there are a couple times where he is just completely speechless and he plays someone who legitimately cannot talk.
Yeah.
And it's done to a cartoonishly level, which sometimes didn't work for me, but other times I found really funny.
Probably depends on the director too.
Yes. Yeah. Probably. I mean, I don't know if there was like a producer, like who put this together in the first place.
I think Quentin Tarantino had a lot to do with it. And like, if you look at like the music taste, the music choices, that seems very Quentin-esque.
Yeah.
But I don't know that for sure.
The only other thing I want to say before we dive into the segments are, so I guess we didn't mention it earlier, but I would rate this movie higher than The Player. I would probably give it a Bruce W.
Oh, yeah. I would probably give it a Bruce Space at least. Let me look at my list really quick before I commit to that for sure, because I don't want to say that I like loved or hated this movie, because this is a movie where I had a lot of diverging opinions on. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to,
which makes sense because it's an anthology movie.
It is an anthology movie. And so you get like a lot of different stuff going on in this movie. And it was very, very difficult for me to actually give it like a placement, because I was placing it on my list. Yeah, I guess I would place it, you know, I guess I would give it a Bruce Space. So I recommend this movie, but it just passes that mark. Just passes it. Yeah, I give it a Bruce Space. And you said you gave it a Bruce W?
Yeah, I'd give it a Bruce W. Maybe a Bruce W. I really like this movie, but I found it a bit of a challenge, and I could see why people wouldn't like it as much.
Yeah. Like this movie, I don't know if you looked up any reviews of it or not, but it just got eviscerated.
Oh, I had read some people talking about how bad the reviews were.
Yeah.
So first of all, we already mentioned it's an anthology movie. Mm-hmm. What do you think of anthologies in general? So I personally really enjoy anthology stories. Mm-hmm. So think of like Black Mirror, for example, is a mm-hmm. modern classic. I think self-contained stories where there's like a connective piece, I find really enjoying, because mm-hmm. one of my major complaints with a lot of movies and a lot of stories is they tend to drag on too long in order to fit the medium. So yeah. a play or a movie or, you know, sometimes even a TV show, they have to fit the full hour or the 2 hours or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I will be like, this should be cut down, but no one wants to watch a 20-minute, you know, play or movie.
Yeah.
But if you do an anthology story of a whole bunch of stories that kind of all have the same theme and same characters, I will almost always like find that more enjoyable.
Yeah.
So this already like had me from the premise, and I knew that premise going in. I didn't know what the four stories were going to be.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is the opening was this wonderfully animated,
like Pink Panther-esque.
Yeah, yeah, of like yeah. him, and it was kind of a little bit of foreshadow was like what he's about to get into, but more whimsical. But Pink Panther was a good description of just like ridiculous bellhop mm-hmm. antics that he had to go into.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say that I like anthology stuff in theory, but I think that it's usually plagued by a problem of not every part working as well as it could. And I feel like, I'm not sure if that's just a thing where they're like, oh, we have a really great idea for this, but then they run into the same problem that you're talking about, where it's like a good portion of it's filler. Like, did you watch The Ballad of Buster Scruggs by any chance?
Yep.
I felt like two of the six or whatever stories were really good, and then the other ones I just did not like at all.
Oh, wow.
And so
I liked probably two-thirds enough, and probably like half I really enjoyed, but like two-thirds I thought were fine.
Fine, yeah. So I feel like my big problem with anthology movies is that I really have to know what that connective tissue is and I have to identify with it. So I really like the framing device of this movie, and I just don't think every story works mm-hmm. as well. But I like anthology things as a medium, I'd say.
Yeah. Okay, let's go through the segments here real quick.
Yeah.
So the first one is directed by
Allison Anders.
Allison Anders.
And it's called The Missing Ingredient.
Yeah. And I was like, these witches show up to cast some spell.
And
like,
an oven of witches.
Yeah,
or
an oven of witches is an oft-repeated joke. And I was like, okay. And then they're like, oh no, we don't have the required semen. And I was like, oh my god.
Yeah, this movie starts out with like laser eyes and stuff, and then like that comes up and you're like, what am I getting into?
Yeah, and I was like, what is happening? And uh-huh. then half of them just get naked and dance around, and I'm like, what is happening?
Yep.
That was a bizarre opening.
Yeah, I had like a couple of friends over to watch this movie, and we were all like,
So Madonna is one of the witches.
Yep.
And I was like, she's wearing this
like black vinyl.
Yeah, it's like a vinyl thing. Leather skin tight suit. And I was like, what on earth?
Yeah. Like two of the five women go topless, and then you're like,
yeah, but
is
not
this
even,
part
not even for,
of
yeah, not the, even for any reason.
Yeah.
Just like, well, all right, it's that time.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, more power to you, I guess. It was just like, it was odd. And like, they each have like a thing that they're supposed to bring. And one of the women is like, the sweat of five man's thighs. And she says it in like the most Owen Wilson sort of way. And I was just like losing it.
Yeah.
So I was very down with it. And then all of a sudden it was like, oh, and I didn't bring the semen because I swallowed. And it was like, oh, okay. And then it like cuts to Tim Roth, and you're like, oh no.
Yeah, and he's just like, what the? Which I was surprised that this was, I mean, I guess I shouldn't be that surprised, but it was interesting to find that this was the only segment written and directed by a woman, mm-hmm. that she chose to write this segment.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know much about Allison Anders' work.
Yeah, I don't know much about her work either. I know that she did like a few movies that were received decently well, and then kind of pivoted to TV. And then Robert Rodriguez obviously is does a lot of different types of movies, kids movies and action movies mostly, and then Quentin Tarantino does Tarantino movies, and then Alexander Rockwell I think doesn't do as much right now.
Yeah, Alexander Rockwell has the smallest, I think, IMDb page. He did 12 things, and he did a movie last year called Sweet Thing, but other than that, he directed 12 movies. But yeah, so I didn't know that much about Allison Anders, but I thought this was fine. I found it kind of whimsical and funny.
Yeah, it had like very Death Becomes Her sort of vibes, and the fact that it was about like witches too kind of helped that. Yep. I felt,
and it leaned into the goofy special effects, like she's, you know, using laser eyes and they summon the goddess Diana or whoever comes out of the whirlpool. Yeah, I thought that was all.
Yeah,
that was all funny.
It was all right, but then I was like, I just don't. Man, this is such a weird thing, and I was interested in the movie, but I was not like totally vibing with that segment, especially because it just ends like on such a weird note. Like that story feels like it kind of starts out somewhere, or it feels like it starts out nowhere, might be going somewhere, and then goes back to nowhere land, and you're like, I don't know. Like
that's the joy of the anthology. They just kind of set up some stuff, had like a punchline, and then moved on. He gets the girl's number. Right. Who?
Oh yeah.
The whatever which number
that gets him
extracted
laid.
Him.
Yeah, that extracted him. Oh my god! I think I hate that. I would like a big old serving of nope for that from now on.
Yeah, like they had sex in the whirlpool or whatever. They're like, we just did it here in order to make sure it all worked.
Oh man. Yeah, that segment is it's a lot.
That's for sure.
It is a lot.
Let's talk about the next segment, the one directed by Alexander Rockwell.
Mm-hmm.
Rockwell.
Yeah.
This one's called The Wrong Man. This was my least favorite.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, segment.
I think I like this one a little bit more than I like the first one.
Interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because, so basically, he comes into the situation where there's a woman that's tied up and has a gag in her mouth, and this guy is like popping pills, drinking whiskey straight from a bottle, and is waving a gun around, and he is like, he goes into the wrong room by accident because he is supposed to bring ice to a different room that is having a party, and the people who are there are too drunk to get the room right, so he goes to the wrong room. And in this, I was just constantly like, what is going on? Because at first you think that there is like a like literal kidnapping going on, or like some sort of hostage situation. And then you start to realize that it might not be, it might be like some sort of sexual fantasy that they're both playing
at the end. So Jessica Beals plays the, Jennifer Beals, sorry, other Beals. Jennifer Beals plays the woman tied up, his wife supposedly.
Uh-huh.
And David Provol plays the husband,
who's just totally deranged.
And what's funny is, at least I never was quite sure if we're supposed to think that the husband slept with somebody else or the wife slept with somebody else, because they kept like dancing around the subject, and he would be like, all right, I didn't sleep with anybody. And you're like, okay, so he's the one that's in under question. And then he's like, now you say it. And then he's like, what? And then he's trying to get Tim Roth to voice every word. And I was like, what is going on?
Yeah.
And then it ends with Jennifer Beals' character just saying every word for penis she could think of and driving him bananas.
Yep.
And I was like, this is weird and kinky. Yep. And then I was like, is this just going to be four weird, kinky episodes in this hotel?
Yeah. It's not.
No,
but,
it's not.
But yeah, I didn't quite get it at first, but I listened to like a podcast about this one as well, because I was interested to hear what other people had to say about it. And like while listening to that, I had like the biggest duh moment where I was like, oh, these two people were sent out like a 1995 equivalent of a Craigslist ad looking for a kinky third person to come in and be that third person that's there. And then Tim Roth comes into the room by accident. So then they think that this is supposed to be the third person, but then they figure out that it's not, and then they continue to roll with it. And so that's why that all is happening. You're like, oh my God, that's so funny. So I feel like knowing that makes that room a lot better.
It definitely was
Because it's so confusing when you're watching
the
it.
Room, the segment's called, what, The Wrong Room or something?
The Wrong Room.
Wrong Man.
The Wrong Man, yeah.
The Wrong Man. And it opens with these, like, drunk guys having a disco calling for ice.
Yeah.
And they give them the wrong room number.
Yeah.
And you as soon as, like, drunk guys, like, guess at the room number, you're like, oh, I know where this is going.
Yep.
And
then I Nowhere was
like,
good.
And then I was like, well, that doesn't make any sense. But what you said, now I understand. I think if I had known ahead of time that they were also waiting on someone, that would have made that a little more enjoyable. I was just very on edge while watching it, and I was like, this is making me uncomfortable, and I don't know what's about to happen. Because they're, like, waving guns around.
Yeah.
And,
but now knowing that, I'm like, was it even, like, an actual gun? Because I don't know that it was.
Well, and we see Jennifer Beals later, and she's just lounging. So obviously she was doing fine.
Yep. Yeah, so that, like, answers the question of whether or not it's, like, a legitimate scary situation. But, yeah, while watching the movie, I kept being like, man, when would I leave? And I would definitely leave after I got a gun waved at my face, unless I had just agreed to watch a mob boss's kids a couple minutes before, which is the next scene.
Now we're going to get to the next scene. So this one is directed by Robert Rodriguez. This is my favorite of the four.
Yeah, it's called the Misbehaviors, and it is not just your favorite of the four. It is my favorite of the four as well, because it's the best one of the four.
So the premise is that Antonio Banderas...
Love him.
Yeah, who has a fantabulous role as a gangster in this. Him and his wife are in the hotel room, and they're getting their kids ready to go out because it's new. I don't know if we said this, but this is New Year's Eve.
Oh yeah.
So
it's like our third holiday movie that we've covered
at least. And it's New Year's Eve, and they are getting ready to go out to their holiday party, and they have two kids who are probably, like, I don't know, 8 and 5 or something.
Something like that. Yeah.
Like fairly young, a boy and a girl. And they're struggling to get their hair right. And they're doing this silly thing where, like, Antonio Banderas is like, you have to get your hair down like this, and it doesn't work. And I found that all funny. And then they're finally like, what if we just didn't take our kids?
Yeah.
And they bring in Tim Roth, and they're like, all right, here's $500. You have to watch our kids for us. And so then they leave, and the kids obviously get into shenanigans the whole time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And their shenanigans are great, because I saw two kids, and I was like, fuck, I gotta watch kids? No. And then, like, I had the sudden aha moment where I was like, oh my god, Robert Rodriguez is great at directing kids.
Yeah.
He gets such good performances out of them. And I should have remembered that he did Spy Kids, because if I had remembered that he had done Spy Kids and Sharkboy versus Lava Girl, I would have probably gone into it going, okay, he knows what he's doing with these kids' parts. And they're really funny. The little girl especially is hilarious, because she's just sending Tim Roth through the ringer, because the Antonio Banderas character is like, if you need anything, you talk to him. And then Tim Roth is like, all right, in case of emergencies, talk to me. And she's like, nope, if I need anything, I'm talking to you. And so then it's just like, she needs cookies or she needs whatever, and she's just calling him up for every little thing. And he's like,
but
he's
also
going nuts.
What's so great about this is not only are they, like, legitimately causing trouble, they're also external circumstances are also happening to them.
Yes.
And so, like, they're not that bad, but also bad things are happening. And then
it just goes super bad once they find a needle that's just like in
they find a huge syringe.
Yeah.
And so they decide to paint a dartboard on the wall, and then they find a dead body.
Yeah.
And they're, like, calling up, and then they light the place on fire. The ending of that scene is great, because it all converges on, like, one final, like, what?
And then Antonio Banderas' character walks in, and then is just like,
his wife is, like, passed out, and he's carrying her back to the hotel room. And
did they misbehave? While there's a fire going on in the background.
That part I thought was funny. One of the things I forgot to mention in the last scene, the wrong man. There's a scene, I think it's that one, where he tries to escape out the bedroom window, and he goes to the bathroom, and he climbs out the window, and it sounds like at first that someone is in the toilet, because there's, like, clothes or blood or something in the toilet, and he climbs on the toilet and, like, steps on the handle, and as it flushes, you hear this scream, And my wife and I are both like, did someone just get flushed down the toilet? What the fuck just happened? And then you finally realize that it's Tim Roth screaming, but he has such a high-pitched scream that it doesn't sound like the scream you're expecting. And then he's sticking his head out the window, and he looks up, and he sees a guy from the disco that he was supposed to go to, and he barfs right down on top of him. And I was like, that is disgusting. Also, in the Antonio Banderas segment, The Misbehaviors, when he walks in and sees the dead body, it just, like, projectile vomits on the ground. Yeah. Just immediately, oh, like, man. Oh, God. I was like, oh, this is so
good. Yeah. And then he's also just like, there's a dead whore in the mattress. And then this little girl's like, she's not a whore. Yeah. Like, it's so good. Like, for 1995, I mean, like, sex work is work. Good job. I appreciate you guys.
I love that whole bit.
Oh, man. It was so funny. Yeah. Once I watched part three, I was like, okay, so parts one and two are going to be so-so. Parts three and four are going to be great. And it wasn't like that for me. I didn't really feel like part four was like the greatest thing I'd ever seen, but part three was just tremendous.
Yeah, part three definitely by far my favorite. So let's talk about part four. Part four was directed by Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah.
And it,
and Tim Roth at this point is like, I'm done. Yeah, so I'm out of here.
He calls the like hotel owner and he says, I'm going to quit. I'm done. I've had it.
Yeah.
And just as he's about to quit, the penthouse calls. And she's like, you have to take this call. It's the last thing you do.
And then you can leave for the night.
Yep. And so he goes up to the penthouse. And in the penthouse is Quentin Tarantino and his posse of homies.
Yep.
One of which is Bruce Willis in a terrible goatee.
Oh, man. It was so bad.
Yeah, it was the worst goatee. I don't have like anything to compare this to, but the whole premise of this plot line is two people have bet things. One guy bet his finger, and then Quentin Tarantino's character bet his car.
Mm-hmm.
And the gist of the bet is if this guy can light his lighter 10 times, he'll get Quentin Tarantino's car. And if he doesn't, he loses his finger.
Mm-hmm.
And the setup is Tim Roth is told to bring up like a random selectment of stuff. And like no one really, it doesn't make any sense. It's a sandwich. It's a bucket of ice. A sharp knife, a cutting board.
And a donut.
Yeah, and one donut.
Yeah.
And they're like going through all the stuff and they're like, okay, the ice is to put the finger on. The board is, and the knife are to cut the finger off. And then the donut, and Quentin Tarantino's like, that's mine. And
he just eats it all in one bite. Yeah.
And then the sandwich is Jennifer Beals. And she's like, that's mine. Because she's also just hanging out there.
Oh, yeah. So Jennifer Beal from earlier was apparently at the pool while the other stuff is happening. And then Quentin Tarantino is like, how about you come up to my penthouse and we'll drink not champagne. What do they call
Cristal.
It? Cristal. Yeah, we'll drink Cristal.
Yeah. He makes a big point of being like, you can't just call this champagne. This is Cristal.
Yeah. And Quentin Tarantino is playing like a parody version of himself.
Yeah. And I think that's probably why I think, again, if someone else had played Tarantino's role, I would have liked this a little more.
Yeah.
Same. I don't mind the writing. It's just Tarantino already on screen, and we talked about this a little in Pulp Fiction, is a little grating.
Mm-hmm.
And this, since he's parodying himself, it's even more grating.
Yeah.
And it gets a little too up its own ass.
Oh, yeah.
In, like, Tarantino loves dialogue, and that's why his movie dialogue is fantastic. And I think one of the ways you can kind of mark Tarantino's career over time is the new movies are the same level of like quick-witted fast patter dialogue, but it all really like works and flows together. Whereas older Tarantino movies, the dialogue is still trying to be quick and witty, but a lot of the times you're like, it's a little too much and it's a little too syncopated in the way. And this particularly, I found him like extremely excruciating. And I was like, oh, when is the scene going to be over? Cause it was very hard to bear.
Yeah. And it's also, it doesn't help that it's like a lot of long takes. Like when he goes into the room, it's like a 7 minute
super long. Yeah. I was wondering if the whole scene was going to be that way because I didn't notice it. Obviously you don't notice a long take at the beginning, but at some point I was like, oh my God, has this been just one long take? And then they finally do some camera cuts near the end. I think I would have liked it more if this had not been the final thing.
Yeah.
I think
Robert Rodriguez should have been the final.
Yeah, because I think I was kind of like, you know, feeling my way through the movie, and I was like, all right, I'm getting done, I'm winding down with this movie, and then it was like a super energetic Tarantino hit me over the head. And like a lot of, again, another a very Tarantino thing was a lot of exposition that didn't need to be there. It was like exposition for exposition's sake.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of
red herrings.
The summary of what is going on, we just summarized. It's just a bet between two people, and they have to re-emphasize it over and over again. And then Tim Roth wants to leave, and then Tarantino's like, no. And then he slowly counts out $1,000 and is like, every 60 seconds is another $100 or whatever. You can do it. And that's why, though, it has to be at the end, because Tim Roth is at the end of his rope and he wants to quit. But yeah, it's like $1,000 there in front of him. And so he's like, all right, fine, I'll stay.
Well, I thought that like the pitch on, I liked it a lot more. Once Tim Roth sat down to listen to Quentin Tarantino do the pitch, it's like a bunch of really fast cuts. And so I feel like you could do a lot more takes, and it's going to be a little bit more of a dialed in performance than like a long take would be. And it's Tim Roth on the edge of his rope. And so I feel like that actually worked a lot better than the first part of the scene did. Like I would give the ending bit of that scene like a 4 out of 5, and the beginning bit like a 1.5 out of 5.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
And so the Tim Roth like agrees, and he's like, all right, I'll do it. And everybody gets all set up, and he takes the money, or he like sets the money out in front of him, and the guy pulls out the lighter and he misses the first one.
Yeah.
And just immediately like shink, off goes the finger. He picks up the money, walks out the door, and he's just got the like fuck you look as he just saunters out the door, and everybody else is freaking out because they were obviously not prepared for that really to happen, and they were just, you know, half drunk, kind of like, this sounds great.
Yeah.
And he's like, where's the finger? Find the finger. And like, oh, the ice is melting. And like, I was like, oh, that was pretty good.
Yep.
Good move.
Yeah.
Good
I love the ending of this movie. It was definitely definitely fun to watch. But yeah, I had the like thought while watching it that I definitely wanted to ask you about it. At which point during the movie, first off, would you be like, if you were Tim Roth's character, would you be like, nope, fuck this, I'm out of here?
So if we're going on the timeline model, where he's babysitting those kids.
Yeah, so he's already agreed to babysit when room number two happens.
I probably would have done the same thing that Tim Roth would have done.
Yeah.
I would have been like, all right, I'm out of here after the...
Going up to this penthouse.
Yeah, well, I probably would have been, I'm out of here after the kids were like... I think I would have done the same thing where after the kids burned down the place and there's a dead body and a drug syringe, I would have called my boss and been like, I'm fucking out of here. And she would have been like, nope, stay with the penthouse. And I'm like, all right, fine. And then I see $1,000, you know, me, measly bellhop man, I would have been like, all right.
Yep. Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Would you say yes to the, first off, say yes to the $100 for sitting in the chair for 60 seconds to listen to the pitch?
I think so.
Yeah, even with that needle having been in your leg of a possible poison or whatever?
Oh, maybe.
I think I'm the same way where I'd be like, yeah, all right. And then would you take the $1,000 to cut off the guy's finger if he misses? You would?
I think if I was in the bellhop's position where like your life is not going that well for you and you can use $1,000.
What about if it's you as Kendrick? Would you take that $1,000 to chop off somebody's finger in
like
theory?
Today?
Yeah, you today.
No, probably not.
You wouldn't?
Nah.
Yeah, I don't know that I would either. What's your price though that you would sit there, somebody is like, I'd give you $10,000 if you chop off this guy's finger, no repercussions. If
it was just finger, I would do $10,000.
Yeah.
Maybe like $5,000.
Yeah. I think somewhere above $1,000 is where my limit's at.
Yeah.
So
yeah. I mean, yes, you could probably reattach fingers, and it's just a finger and he's probably fine. He's gonna be fine. But still, like, that's,
I know,
pretty
it's
irrelevant.
Chopping off somebody's finger.
One of my favorite lines in that bit in the last room is Tarantino talks about how, you know, your life is made up of a lot of kind of meaningless moments, and very few moments do you remember your whole life. And he's like, tonight is going to be one of those moments,
regardless of whether or not you decide to chop off the guy's finger.
And that's true. Like, you want to do that, somebody is gonna, you know. You're getting $1,000, whether you have to chop off the finger.
Yeah.
I also liked how he was selling, the guy who lost a finger was like, look, I drive a really shitty old Honda. Tarantino's got this really nice car. I need a new car. I'm willing to risk it.
Yep. Which is great, because it means that the guy's finger to him is worth as much as the car is, which is wild.
Yeah. Which yeah. maybe it's a nice car.
Yeah, maybe.
It's like a Porsche or something.
Maybe.
Oh,
the other thing that I wanted to talk about with that fifth room or fourth room is that Jessica Biel is there and she just came up
Jennifer
from the
Biel?
What?
Jennifer Biel?
Yes. Fuck you. Jennifer Biel is there.
It'd been weird if Jessica Biel is also like,
you said Jessica Biel earlier. yeah, Jennifer Biel is up there and she just came back from the pool. So she's got like a bathrobe on and her swimsuit's drying and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
But she also has, surprisingly enough, no shoes, no socks on in the Tarantino segment. Just bare feet. Yeah, I know. And I was like, I did not catch that. And then I was watching the scene through again today and I was like, wait a second. Wait a second.
The Tarantino checklist.
Yep. Yep. Mr. Footman. Bring me some.
So Bruce Willis has, again, a really tiny role in this. He just plays kind of a like the background guy in this scene. He's on the phone most of the time with his wife or partner or someone arguing about how
he's too drunk to drive home.
Yeah, he's too drunk to drive home.
Yeah.
Did you know that he's uncredited in this movie?
I did, yeah.
Because he performed for free. Yep. And apparently that goes against SAG rules. And they agreed not to sue him if he took his name out of the credits. Yeah. Although his hairdresser is in the credits. which is interesting because you mentioned that in The Player, a lot of them act for free. And I was wondering if it was legitimately free or just like $1.
It might have not been a dollar, though, because I think that there's like limits on how much you have to get paid and stuff like that. Oh. But it might have been different in 1992 versus 1995. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe they're not credited.
I don't know. No. They are because they're in the end of the credits of the movie.
Oh, okay.
It scrolls through with all these people as themselves.
It's
just a large.
Maybe that. Maybe there's like a special rule for cameos.
Oh, it might be
like
if they're as
appearing
themselves.
As yourself.
Yeah. And it's also like all those were super, super tiny roles too in The Player. So
and The Player is like has much more characters.
Yeah.
Whereas
for
Bruce,
sure.
Yeah. So I don't know what the specific rules are there, but I found that kind of interesting. Because
sure.
I was like, where's Bruce Willis in his credits? Like he definitely has a big enough role to get a credit.
Yeah.
You're like, what's going on? So I was interested to find that out.
Yeah, and he's not in, they don't say his name in the trailer either. But he's in the trailer.
Yeah. The trailer for this movie is, I found really funny. And I thought was like a great, it was a great taste of like what this movie will be. Because it's just a whole bunch of ridiculousness kind of all slammed in together. And it's really quickly edited.
Yeah, good little smattering. For sure.
So, Star Trek Connection for Four Rooms. Again, because this movie has a bunch of bit players, there's probably a bunch that I'm missing. But I wanted to call out Mark Lawrence. He played is the old man bellhop at the beginning, mm-hmm. who's like handing off the bellhop baton.
Yeah.
And he he has a couple different Star Trek side characters,
mm-hmm.
but one of my favorite is Carl Zemo, who is a holographic like gangster.
Oh,
in,
nice.
In some of Bashir's holograms.
Ah, yes.
So I thought that was
oh, great. Man, Bashir. Bashir. Nice.
And then for the box office.
This movie had a $4 million budget. So I would guess that each director got $1 million to
make their
segment. Yeah. And it brought in $4.2 million at the box office because it was eviscerated by critics. So it barely scraped back its money. But, you know, it wasn't that big of an investment anyway. So I think everybody basically came out on top of it.
What's interesting is Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino, both very well known nowadays. The other two, much less so. And I don't know if in 95 when this was made, if that was the case, like were they all kind of equally well known? Like Quentin Tarantino would have done Pulp Fiction,
mm-hmm.
and so that would have gotten him kind of a big name.
Yeah, he was the most well known of the four, I think, and then the other three I'm pretty sure were like around the same level of unknownness.
Gotcha.
But yeah, Miramax was apparently like, yeah, here's $4 million, go make whatever the fuck you want to make.
I mean, that was a pretty cheap budget, and that's why like Bruce Willis had to do for free because of the favor to Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, yeah. His paycheck alone would have eaten up that entire budget. So, yeah. Right. Many times over.
Yep.
Yeah. So we're not going to put this in the official ranking of our movies, but just whereabouts in general would you put these two movies?
So we've done 22 movies so far.
Mm-hmm.
I think both of these would probably go kind of in the middle.
Yeah.
I like Four Rooms better than The Player, but for me, both of them kind of just go right about the middle of the pack.
Yeah. Yeah. I put The Player up towards the top. It was actually my number one for a while, but 12 Monkeys took that spot. So for me right now, it'd be like 12 Monkeys, The Player, and then Pulp Fiction. And then for Four Rooms, I liked it a little bit less. And so that one goes in between In Country and North. And I actually bumped Last Man Standing down one more, the more that I had thought about Last Man Standing. So, and editing that episode, I was like, man, I like this movie too much. I'm knocking that one down one. So.
Yeah, I mean, you still liked it a lot more than me, it looks like. But
yeah. Yep. Yeah, but I also like North more than you. So, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm allowed to have wrong opinions, as we've established beforehand.
Yep. What do I like more than you?
Death Becomes Her, for sure.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's like the big standout one. And Color of Night.
Yep.
Yep. Yep. Okay, cool. Well, do you know what time it is? What does your watch say?
Hold on. It says... Will of Willie, Will of Willis. Ah, it's time for the Wheel of Willis.
All right, all right. Well, do you know what we say every time we spin the Wheel of Willis?
I'm really excited because we never get to say it at the same time. We always say it slightly offset because of the way time and physics work.
Yep.
But now we only say it slightly offset because of how physics works.
Yes.
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 See how that worked? We had to wait for the sound to get through the room. And
oh man,
that's a joke.
That is a joke. You know, I think it qualifies under the rule. Scrolling through my book really quick, it does actually qualify under the rule of jokes.
For you audio listeners, Josh actually pantomimed scrolling through a book, flipping through a book just now. So I hope that you enjoyed that bit.
Well, what do we say every time we spin the Wheel of Willis, Kendrick?
Every time we say, whisk that wheel!
Okay, so this is for The Player. And it has been whisked. Okay, and the question is, if this Bruce Willis was an ice cream flavor, what flavor would he be?
Okay, so for The Player.
The Player.
He is going to be...
I feel like something consistent, something that you can rely on.
Oh, but I was thinking a flavor that had like a bombastic, like it's, you just bring it in to, you don't eat it all the time. You just have it like.
Oh, it's like the top shelf.
Yeah. It's ice like, cream. Oh, I'm having a great meal. I'm going to pull out this, like, I don't know, you know, 7-layer chocolate or whatever.
All right.
Because he comes in and it's just like a huge to do.
He's like a huge thing. Yeah, I was going with, like, everybody is talking about how they're just like, oh, yeah, we'll get somebody like Mel Gibson or Bruce Willis for this. So I'm thinking, like, all right, what's, like, old reliable? So I was thinking, like, maybe a Rocky Road.
Yeah. All right.
Yep. All right. Cool. All right. So now we're going to do the same thing again. Are we going to say whisk that wheel again?
Does the wheel whisk without us saying it?
I don't know if it does. I've never tried it before. Let's see. Nope, it doesn't work.
All right, I guess we'll say it again.
Well, join along with us at home, audience members. Whisk that wheel!
Again.
Oh, man. All right. So this question is... Somehow we got the same exact one.
Wait, really?
Yeah, I forgot to hide it. So somehow we ended up on the same exact thing. Okay, if Bruce Willis's character asked you for your shoes, would you give them to him or would he have to convince you? So if he's like, ironic, hey, can I have your shoes?
Ironically, he's in the room with Quentin Tarantino, yeah, who probably would require Bruce Willis to be barefoot.
Yep. Yeah.
So I think this is pretty true. Accurate. Yeah. I think he would have to convince me, but then once he pointed out that Quentin Tarantino wanted him barefoot and it's real weird and now there's like an emergency and you got to take the finger to the hospital, I would probably let him do it.
Yeah.
But I would need a little bit of convincing.
Yeah. I don't think I would ever, like, unless Bruce Willis has a gun and he's like, I need your shoes. I'm not going to be like, well, yeah, here, yeah, you can have my shoes just because you asked nicely. Like, if Bruce Willis was like a diehard Bruce Willis or a, what's the movie called where he Mortal Thoughts? Yeah, if he was a Mortal Thoughts Bruce Willis, where he's just like this ass hat drug addict, and he's like, "Give me your shoes," I'd be like, "Okay, fine, whatever. Like, don't kill me." So
I think, yeah, it depends on what's part of that four room segment. But if they had been at a finger in a bucket of ice and run into the hospital, I'd be like, "All right, yeah, you can have my shoes."
I guess I don't.
And
need
if I'm at the
bad.
Hotel and I don't need the shoes right now,
Yeah, thank you, by the way, for people that sent those in. Those were not ones that we came up with. So if you ever have Wheel of Willis suggestions, please send those in. You can tweet at us. We are at Willis Waypod, or you can send us an email at williswaypod@gmail.com.
If you want to support this podcast, one of the best ways you can support this podcast is by leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts. So Apple Podcasts may not be the podcast feed you listen to, but those reviews do mean a lot, and they are the main way podcasts get reviewed. So check that out on Apple Podcasts. Leave a review. It just takes a few seconds. If you want to find other episodes of this show, you can check out williswaypod.com. You can also go over to lastoftheactionheroes.com for more of those episodes.
You can find me, Josh, on Twitter at Joshing Carter.
And you can find me on Twitter also at K Martinix. That's spelled K-M-A-R-T-I-N-I-X. Next week, Josh, we're going to be talking moonlighting.
Yeah, we're talking moonlighting.
I'm excited. So I have seasons 1 through 3 on DVD. And there's a fourth season, though. I don't have that on DVD, unfortunately.
And a season 5 as well.
Oh, there is?
Yep.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, I don't have either of those two seasons.
Okay.
So we won't be able to do seasons 4 and 5. But
we're not reviewing the entirety of the series.
Definitely not reviewing the entirety of the series. I've already watched a handful of episodes in preparation.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have watched any.
Nope.
Okay. So I'm excited to talk about
it. I've been doing schoolwork, but I'm done with classes as of tomorrow, so I definitely have time to watch a couple.
I'm going to the School of Moonlighting.
Hey, that's right. Yeah, I got a degree in Bachelor of Moonlighting.
Yeah. I'm excited to talk to you about this.
So yeah.
It'll be fun.
Yeah. It'll be early Bruce Willis, too, so I'm assuming he still has hair and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. Oh, I'm so excited.
And it's also very easy. I forgot how time has changed.
Well, yeah. Join us next week. As always, thank you guys for listening. Have a good one.
Have a good one. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Oh, yes, it's fun, then.